Welcome to the Revenue Lounge, a podcast for revenue operations professionals who want to understand the various facets of this important go-to-market function. In each episode, the team at Nectar interviews revenue warriors on how they are reimagining revenue operations in creative and disruptive ways, and what are their secrets to building a scalable and predictable revenue engine. Let's get started.
While having access to data has become easier, making sense of it, ensuring its quality, and using it effectively has become increasingly challenging. From breaking down data silos to navigating shifting privacy regulations, marketing teams are constantly adapting to maintain customer trust while driving impactful campaigns. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revenue Lounge podcast. I am your host, Randy Likas. And in this episode, we will dive into the complexities of overcoming marketing data challenges. We'll discuss the future of personalized marketing in a privacy-first world and the evolving role of first-party data in shaping effective strategies. And joining me today is Liana Dubois. Liana is the Chief Marketing Officer at Nine, where she has held various leadership roles for the past 12 years. She's also an advisory member in the Growth Committee for Women in Media Australia and a member of the Board of Advisors of Industry Inclusively Made. Liana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Randy. Awesome to be here to have a chat.
Yeah, I'm excited for the discussion. For those that might not be familiar with Nine, can you maybe give us a little bit of an overview of the company and then share a little bit about your background and your current role at Nine?
For sure. So Nine is Australia's largest locally owned media organization. We're a multimedia business. We are the product of M&A activity, actually. So we have a very vast media platform that we like to refer to as an integrated audience ecosystem. But what all of those buzzwords mean is we have channel assets that span the television media landscape, the audio media landscape, the publishing media landscape, and also we have marketplaces across real estate and auto categories. And we have a subscription video on demand platform as well called Stan, which is Australia's competitor to Netflix. So we have a sort of a vast channel mix. We are both an advertiser-funded media organization, and we also have diversified revenues into the subscription landscape. My role here at Nine as Nine's Chief Marketing Officer spans sort of a group remit. If I had to write my role remit in one sentence, it would be to grow commercializable audiences. That's the job of the group CMO here. My background is probably a little different to many marketers' backgrounds, actually. I'm marketing trained, but actually this is my very first what you would call client-side role. My history, which spans, unfortunately or fortunately, 25 years in the media industry, actually started out in the commercial landscape. So I have had predominantly what you would know as sort of front-facing sales roles, where it's been my job to sell media inventory to marketers and advertisers, essentially. So selling TV advertising, radio advertising, publishing advertising, etc. So I spent the vast majority of my career commercializing media inventory, which I think has set me up beautifully for now having the job of growing commercializable audiences, because I have an acute and very deep understanding of how media makes its money, and marketing is a commercial role. So having that sort of business acumen and that sales acumen has really helped to set me up for success in this role. I've also held roles in strategy, sponsorship, integration, so how you integrate brands in and around content. And then I stepped into the CMO role, I think, near on 2.5 years ago now. So that's my background.
Fantastic. What a great diverse background that you have, especially coming from the sales side of things. That gives you a really good appreciation for what the teams go through to sell media and advertising. So I have a quick question. With the presence across so many different platforms, how do you integrate data from those various sources to build a cohesive strategy for advertisers?
Yeah, so great question. So we have a CDP, or a customer data platform, with Adobe. And we use that CDP essentially to manage effectively, efficiently, and privately. Of course, there is privacy and legislation that exists currently, and it is actually changing in the very near future. But we use that CDP to manage the 22 million signed in users that we have across all of our platforms. So there's roughly 27 million people in Australia. We are small compared to the US, but we have 22 million of those 27 million Australians signed into any one of our platforms. And so that CDP is really, really imperative to us being able to understand in an anonymized way who those cohorts are, what they're doing inside our integrated audience platform, what they're consuming, how long they're there, what platforms they move around. If somebody's a reader of, say, the Sydney Morning Herald, they might also be a consumer or a watcher of Nine Now. So what shows are they watching? And that helps me as a marketer to be able to move consumers around that ecosystem. But from an advertiser's point of view, it also helps advertisers to be able to segment and target more efficiently and more effectively at scale.
Wonderful. And do you monetize the audience segmentation and behavior different ways, or is that all sort of packaged together for advertisers?
That's a really great question. So it really depends on how the advertiser is viewing the world and what their challenges or opportunities are and what impact they're trying to drive for all of their campaigns. So some advertisers here in Australia very much take a kind of all people approach. So they don't segment and they don't target specific cohorts or specific niches. And that is a fantastic approach for people, for marketers who are trying to not only capitalize on existing demand, but drive future demand with consumers that perhaps are not in market today, but might be in market in the next 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 5 years, depending on the life cycle of your category. But other advertisers, for example, they do want to segment and they want to attract specific cohorts. So they might like to, for example, go after lookalikes. So if they have their own first party data and they have their own customer sort of segmentation, they might like to go after lookalike consumers that have a similar makeup but aren't customers of theirs today. But have a similar makeup to cohorts in their existing customer base, because that feels like low-hanging fruit to be able to attract and bring over. Others like to suppress their current customer base, obviously only go after those that aren't, or vice versa. They like to suppress those that aren't customers and re-engage their existing customer base. And then others are segmenting in entirely different ways, where they might be segmenting automotive intenders or people with pets, or real estate, you know, people looking for a mortgage or those sorts of things. So at Nine, we have a number of partners in the data space that enable us to also understand not just media consumption behavior, which we know at scale, but also other targetable kind of cohort behaviors that we might need to better understand. And so we commercialize in all of those different ways.
Yeah. In the green room, we talked a little bit about the challenge of like too much data, right? Because there's just looking across all the different properties, there's a lot of data. How do you determine what the right data is for driving effective marketing strategies?
Oh, such a good question, and a question I'm actually really passionate about. So as I mentioned just before, as the CMO of Nine, I have 22 million signed in users to my platform. And that is a huge data set. And it's a wonderful data set to have. But it's only one part of the story. All that data is telling me is who I've got, how many I've got in an anonymized way, and what they're doing on my media platforms. It doesn't tell me, as the CMO, whose job is to grow commercializable audiences, it doesn't tell me why they're with me. It doesn't tell me what else they do when they're not with me. And they're really important, you know, data or insight capabilities for me to have to extract from elsewhere to be able to influence how I can get people to come to me more often and to spend more time with me, and to get the remaining 5 million people in the country that aren't with me to come. So I'm constantly asking myself questions like, okay, I've got a huge spreadsheet in front of me or a huge data set in front of me. What is the data that actually matters? And I don't know if it's the same in the US. I would hypothesize it probably is. You know, we're in this industry, in this country, we fall a little bit victim, if I may, to treasuring what we measure today. And there's a lot of kind of legacy measurement constructs that exist, you know, like overnight ratings for television. Overnight ratings for television really are just one tiny part of the picture, because obviously people are watching on demand, in their own time, etc., etc. So we fall a little bit victim to treasuring what we measure rather than measuring what we treasure. And so I think it's really important for other marketers to just ask yourself, what is important for you to understand? Just because I have a 22 million person data set does not mean I have all of the answers with that data set. In fact, far from it. And so just constantly being curious, what else can I learn? Where else can I get data and insight to either back up what I'm seeing or to help me unpack what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. And that kind of curiosity piece for me, I think, is really, really paramount.
How do you measure the success of different campaigns and strategies that you're employing?
So the ways in which we measure today, and we're on a journey of our own, finding better ways to measure what's important to us. But the ways, some of the ways in which we measure today is in the audiences that we bring to our platform, first and foremost. Does a television show deliver the audience that we require it to deliver in order to be able to maximize the commercialization of that product? Does a reader come to the Sydney Morning Herald or the Age or the AFR? Does a listener come to our podcasts, to our radio station, to our streaming platform? So measuring explicit audience numbers. Mm-hmm. The other things, of course, that we measure are things like impressions and engagement, brand salience. We're very, very deep in brand tracking. The brands of Nine's media assets in this country have been building equity in them for, I don't know, our publishing, our oldest publishing brand is about 190 years of age. Our radio brand's roughly 90 odd years of age, and our television brand is roughly 70. So we've been a part of Australian culture for a very, very, very long time. And so mapping brand consistency or brand value is really important. But largely, you know, when your job is to grow commercializable audiences, it's, are our marketing efforts delivering those audiences? Much the same as for an advertiser on our platform. What's an advertiser that you would know in the US? Like Macca's. So let's go with Macca's. The CMO of Macca's job globally is to grow their consumer base and grow their basket size and grow their frequency of purchase. It's similar for me. And so, yeah, I think it's really interesting to unpack the similarities between what an advertiser of a brand like Macca's or Uber or Audi or any of those is doing is really, really similar to the CMO of a media organization.
Yeah. What about data silos? So, you know, I think data silos often just probably disrupt a lot of the marketing efforts that you have. How do you approach breaking down those silos as you're trying to create a unified view of the customer across all the different properties?
Yeah, so we once were a very siloed media organization. So as I said to you in my intro, Nine as a multimedia organization today is the product of M&A activity. Mm-hmm. So we once upon a time, there were four actually standalone businesses. One was a television business, one was an audio business, and one was a publishing business. And those businesses have all come together to unite to become the multimedia organization that we are today. But obviously through that M&A activity, there is a moment in time where you're just four businesses standing next to each other rather than being deeply integrated as one entity. And so the CDP, the implementation of the Adobe CDP, has been paramount to being able to create an integrated audience platform where we have a single view of our customer. It could not have been done without the implementation of a CDP. And my counsel to any marketer who finds themselves in an organization where they have data silos, you know, having a CDP and getting yourself a single view of a customer is absolutely paramount to being able to maximize the understanding that you have of your customer base and then be able to influence the basket size, if you will, the number of products that they're consuming across your platform, the frequency in which they're consuming those products, again, depending on the life cycle of your category, but really important that I can't stress enough the importance of the CDP in enabling us to have a single view of a customer, where I can now go, okay, I know that there's people that are reading the Sydney Morning Herald that dabble in Nine now, and these are the sort of content genres that they're interested in watching from a television point of view. And so if I can target them with other pieces of content that are similar to those sorts of genres that they're already engaging in, then possibly I can get them to spend more time over there and vice versa.
Yeah. Makes you wonder how you got through life before the CDP, right? It was just so challenging before that. Out of curiosity, how long has the CDP been in production for you all?
Yeah, so the CDP has actually only been stood up over the last 12 months in our organization. Oh, wow. So we are getting a lot of really fresh understanding and new understanding. We've had some levels of data and insight historically, and certainly the advertising market has been able to, actually, funnily enough, the advertising market has actually been able to more effectively engage in our data capability than the marketing function inside Nine has been able to until recently. So I think that's probably a really interesting thing for your listeners to understand. But yeah, the last 12 months with the implementation of the CDP and also review of our MarComms capability, our whole MarTech stack, has really started to aid us in being able to grow commercializable audiences into the future.
Yeah. Let's shift a little bit and talk about first-party data. How has the shift towards first-party data impacted your approach to marketing, and what steps have you taken to ensure data quality and relevance?
Sure. So we are somewhat unique in the Australian landscape in that either by good luck or good management, probably a combination of the two, we have held first-party data capability for quite some years. For example, in our television business, when NineNow, which is our AVOD platform, our advertiser-funded video on demand platform, when that was originally stood up, when that was originally created, we made the decision to force, in the politest way, a login requirement for people to be able to consume that content. And that platform is now several years old. And the same can be said for our publishing business and also for our audio business, although it's slightly further behind in its kind of life cycle of transitioning off a traditional broadcast medium into a streaming medium. So first party data has always been, well, for a very long time, has been really, really important to our business. And the importance of it, obviously, is to give you the insights and the understanding of your customer base so that you can better service their needs and their requirements and their wants, but really importantly, done in an ethical and privacy-based and under the guidance of the legislation that exists here in Australia. So that first-party data capability is incredibly important, both for me as the CMO of Nine, but also for our advertising community, particularly while Google have made the choice not to sunset cookies anymore, or certainly for the time being, who knows? The reality is that there are shortcomings all over the place in terms of cookie capability. Cookies are crumbling all over the place, whether they're being sunsetted or not. And so I think for the advertising community, it's really important to be working with partners that have a first-party data capability, because it's going to make your marketing efforts much more effective and much more efficient, particularly if you are looking to target large or small cohorts of a particular type of person or a particular type of behavior.
Mm-hmm. With Google's decision to not move forward or to sunset cookies, how do you see the future of personalized marketing evolving, particularly with respect to privacy-first frameworks?
Yeah, the reality to the answer for that question, Randy, is that I don't actually think anybody really knows, because nobody has a crystal ball. What I would say is whether or not cookies get sunsetted into the future or not, I think is irrelevant for the importance of first-party data. First-party data treated in an ethical and a privacy-first based manner is going to continue to become more important for advertisers and for marketers into the future. Notwithstanding, because of privacy and legislation change, it is going to come with some probably increased challenges or rules, boundaries, and limitations than has historically been the case. That said, if marketers are working with organizations that have well-constructed, privacy-first based, ethically based data practices, then they will be able to unlock incremental value for their own organization in terms of their marketing efforts. But I would say I personally spend a lot of time with my chief data officer and also my general counsel, my legal team here at Nine, making sure that myself and my marketing team and also our commercial team who are interfacing with the advertising market are acutely aware of all of the changes coming and what that will mean for us, because, you know, organizations could find themselves in some real hot water and some very expensive hot water if marketers and advertisers aren't acutely aware of what their rules, boundaries, and limitations are going to be. And so to any marketer out there who's listening, I would really strongly recommend that you go and make very, very, very good friends with your chief data officer, if you have one, otherwise become it, or your legal team, and really encourage everybody to really, really deeply understand what your rules, boundaries, and limitations are as it pertains to first-party data.
Yeah, a little bit unrelated, but you bring up the relationship with legal and relationship with the chief data officer. In the world that we're living in right now with AI and all the opportunities that AI is presenting itself, I think a lot of legal teams right now are a little nervous, right? There's some fear around what that might mean. And any recommendations you have in terms of how to approach those conversations as it relates to AI with those constituents?
Yeah, and AI is another interesting one, right? It's new and it's exciting on one hand and it's mildly scary or challenging on the other. Again, nobody has a crystal ball, so nobody knows where this thing is going. That said, my personal belief, and I could be proven very, very wrong, which is A-OK, but my personal belief is that AI is similar to other forms of new technology that have arrived over decades and decades and decades. It is a tool that will only ever be as good as its tradesperson, and we're all tradespeople using a tool. But I would hazard a guess that we are, if we're not already in peak hype cycle for AI, we will very shortly be in peak hype cycle. In fact, we could have already been in it and we might be slowly falling into the trough of disillusionment before we will normalize like we have with every other piece of technology. And it will just become sort of part of BAU and part of what we do. But we flipped out and wigged out about the internet. We flipped out and wigged out about the arrival of data. We flipped out and wigged out about a whole pile of other technology advancements. And I'm not so sure that this one's much different. But in terms of how we're thinking about AI inside our business, it's absolutely a tool for the using. It is already being used inside our organization. But we did set up very early on a sort of guiding principles, if you will, or a kind of a philosophy about how we would approach AI. And we take a people first approach and a people last approach. So AI is a tool that is used in the middle, but we start with what is right, wrong, or indifferent for our people. And we end with what is right, wrong, or indifferent for our people. And we make conscious choices in terms of what we will and what we will not use it for through a very human and people lens. And so I think when it comes to conversations with, say, your legal team around these sorts of things, if you have guiding principles and if you take a kind of people first approach, it tends to then take the sting out of the tail in terms of like the actual tool itself, because you're doing what you would do with anything else and making conscious choices based on those guiding principles.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent framework. People first or people principles is an excellent advice.
I was just going to build. One of the other things we talk about a lot, or rather is increasing in frequency in terms of the conversations we're having internally, is the notion of ethical choices. And I certainly believe that the rise of the chief ethics officer may be a thing into the future as more technologies, and generative AI is one of them right now, but as more technologies accelerate and pop into the world around us, I think the choices of that old question of just because you can doesn't mean you should, I think starts to become more acute perhaps than it has before. I don't know, but I would watch this space for the rise of the chief ethics officer.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. Related to ethics and sort of the ethical officer, I think there's a big movement right now. It's not new, but maintaining consumer trust or customer trust while delivering that personalized sort of marketing experience is really a balancing act. How do you ensure the privacy is upheld while still creating targeted, impactful campaigns that grow your audiences?
Yeah, it's a good one. In particular in media, trust is, I mean, it's paramount for every business, of course, but in media in particular, when your role in society and culture is to educate, inform, entertain, and you really do influence culture as a media organization, it's so incredibly important. Globally, it is well recognized, unfortunately, that society's trust in media and trust in news media is declining. And so I again, if there's any media colleagues listening, then I would challenge all of us to remind ourselves daily of our role in society as influencers of culture. But in terms of the application of marketing strategies that are underpinned by data and how you can use it effectively without being kind of Big Brother is watching or stalking me around the internet. Again, I go back to just because you can doesn't mean you should. Take a people first approach. Watch your own consumer behavior. Be careful of surveys of one, but what is your own consumer behavior? What is a really helpful way for you to be targeted and a really unhelpful way for you to be targeted? If I've been searching the internet for a new black and white polka dot blouse and I've now found it and purchased it, why am I still being stalked around the internet by black and white polka dot blouses? We constantly are asking ourselves, is that actually a helpful way for consumers, for our consumers to be targeted, or is that an unhelpful way? And so we do talk a lot, both in terms of our own behaviors from a marketing point of view, but also how we talk to advertisers in the market, is targeting at scale rather than targeting really niche cohorts. Because I think when you get to micro-targeting and niche, like super, super, super small, that's when it gets creepy. And that's when it's really unhelpful. And it's actually not a great way to grow your business anyway. So targeting at scale and targeting larger cohorts, I think is a better way in.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think the more minutiae that you get in that targeting, it impacts the overall experience, right? The customer experience as well, because they just don't like it. And that's having the opposite effect, I think, is of what you're out for to begin with.
Yeah. You mentioned this. Also, Randy, it's not a good way to grow business. It's not a good way to grow business because when you get to that kind of level of micro-targeting and minutiae, all you're doing is capitalizing on existing demand, on the 5 to maybe 15% of consumers that are in market for your product right now today.
Yeah.
Whereas you are not hitting the 85 to 95% of consumers that might be in market for your product in the next month, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 5 years if you're an auto.
Yeah.
So like getting that balance right of existing and future demand is absolutely paramount. And that I do see in Australia today, and I suspect it's probably the same in the US, it is the same in the UK. There is too much focus today on existing demand and short term, and not enough focus on future growth.
Yeah, it's the same thing in the US, 100%. I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. There's a lot of sort of real-time overnight ratings, I think is the what you had mentioned, but there's a lot of real-time data validation that you can have as part of your marketing efforts. How do you ensure that the data that you're using is always up to date and reliable, or is there such a thing as too up to date?
Ooh, that's a goodie. So how do you ensure that it's up to date? So there's some really practical stuff. Let's make sure that we're working with partners and collaborators that actually do what they say on the tin and they're good at what they do, for starters. Because I think there's a lot of shonky providers out there. So let's make sure that we're choosing providers that actually have the capability and the skills to be able to support you with what you need. I go back to that kind of being curious all the time and asking questions. And if you're not sure what questions to ask, ask the people around you, reach out to colleagues, what other marketers, advertisers, etc. What's the sort of stuff that I should be thinking about? And let's not anybody be worried about asking questions that they don't know, because everybody is on various different stages of understanding how to unpack all of these things. But be curious and ask questions. Why does the data show me this? Am I seeing, is this what I think the data is showing me? How has the data come to, what's the methodology? How has the data come to light? How up to date is it? And then I do think there is, again, I go back to something I said earlier, I do think there is great risk in people being either overwhelmed by or confused by the amount of data that they have in their hands and not sure which, what is actually going to help them into the future. And so, you know, practically surrounding yourself with people that can help you unpack that, because no one person has got all the answers, is probably the practical answer to the question.
Yeah. Wonderful. I may have let this question out of the bag earlier, but I did want to ask, is there any particular opportunity or maybe the next big challenge for data-driven marketing in the media industry that you're particularly excited about? You know, we talked about AI, but is there anything besides AI that you're particularly excited about or you think might present the next big opportunity?
For me, the next big opportunity is one that has always existed, but again, it's something I'm reasonably passionate about. In a world that seems just hell-bent, to be honest, in being more excited by and more interested in, and there's much more conversation around things like technology and data and all of the sort of science and machine-based stuff that exists in the industry. I actually would like us to go back to, and the opportunity I think we have is to go back to consumer behavior and people and humans and the reality and the fact that marketing exists to influence human beings to do something to drive a commercial outcome. And the best way to influence human beings is through emotion and through creativity and storytelling. And what I would witness in our rush to adopt new technologies and to have data-driven marketing campaigns and all of those sorts of things, we forget humans and we forget creativity and we forget emotion. And the reality is that the impact of, so from a comms point of view, from a communications or an advertising point of view, the actual message, the story, the ad itself is responsible for around about 50% of the impact of a campaign. So let's have a renaissance for creativity and bring back the craft of creative and using creative to influence the emotions of humans to drive them to make a decision. Because while we would all like to believe that we are logical and pragmatic humans that make decisions based on facts and research and all that kind of jazz, it's a lie that we've been telling ourselves. If you speak to any behavioral economics person, anthropologists, psychologists, anybody who specializes in human behavior, they will all tell you that human beings buy on emotion and we justify with fact. So let's go back and start investing in the power of creativity to change the fortunes of business, because that's how you influence humans. Sorry, that was a soapbox rant.
No, I loved it. Dead on. Absolutely. Okay, so last question before we transition to our lightning round. What haven't I asked you about around data-driven marketing or any of the topics that we speak of that maybe I should have? Is there any particular, you know, something that's top of mind for you that I didn't ask that maybe I should have?
Well, I'll go back to my soapbox for a second. The ability and the power of data and insight to help influence creative territories. Creative is, I think, a very misunderstood craft. There is a lot of instinct, obviously, and just general human understanding that goes into the creative craft. But in actual fact, there is a lot of data and insight that goes into underpinning ideas and human thinking and the creative process and ultimately the creative platform that those extraordinary creative minds can develop and come up with. So I think, you know, spending a little bit of time understanding the kind of insight that can be extracted from data, because data and insight are not the same thing, one feeds the other, the kind of insight that you can garner from data to be able to feed that creative process to bring a renaissance to the craft and the ability for creative to change the fortunes of business, I think is it may be another podcast for another day. Randy?
Yeah. So I know I said the last question, but you just said something that I would love to get your perspective on. So what is the difference between data and insight?
So for me, and I'm happy to be argued with or proven wrong, but for me, data is, it's the what, and insight is more around the why and the how, is probably the way that I would unpack that. And, you know, data is a very hard metric, whereas insight takes into consideration, I think, a broader world and obviously human behaviors and those sorts of things. But yeah, if data is the what, insight is the why and the how.
Yeah. Someone once said to me, I asked the same question to someone, and I love their answer, which is data is what it is. It's data points. The connective tissue between the data is the insight.
Yeah.
And I love that metaphor.
It's insight.
Yeah. Okay.
Nice. I like it. I'll steal it with pride.
Yeah. Great. Let's go to the lightning round, which is a little bit more personal. So we'd be curious just to ask you, what is the favorite part of being the CMO at Nine?
Oh, gosh. The favorite part of being the CMO of Nine is actually to realize the place in culture that our brands hold. It's quite a humbling experience. You know, when you are working with a house of brands that have existed for 190, 90 and 70 years and have been influencing culture for that period of time, it's quite a thing. It is quite a thing.
It really
quite
is.
Extraordinary.
And such great heritage of the brands that you represent, right? I think you mentioned 193 years the Herald has been around. I mean, that's incredible. Okay, so there's always going to be a flip side to that question. what is your least favorite, or
the worst?
I would ask a different way, like, what's really hard about your job?
I'm not a big fan of administration and administrative tasks, but that probably feels, you know, that's probably an everyone thing. One of the most challenging things about being a chief marketing officer, and I speak to CMOs all around the place, and I feel like it is a shared challenge, and I'm sure not unique to the role of a CMO either, by the way. But I think stakeholder management and taking people on the journey can be a very, very time consuming part of a role, particularly, you know, if there is not a great depth of understanding of the role of what marketing is and does. And so a big part of your day might be spent helping people to understand what that is rather than actually just doing really great work. And so, as I say, it's a shared challenge of a CMO, I understand, and also probably not unique to the role of a CMO. But I think time and effort spent in education rather than actually doing is certainly an ongoing opportunity for improvement, is what I would say.
Any advice? So I would think of that as you're taking people on the journey with you. There's change that's involved with that and managing that change. Any advice that you've learned over the course of your career in terms of like how to do that best?
Yeah. And look, I don't mind being really, really honest with your listeners. It's definitely still, you know, learning because you're surrounded by different people all day, every day. And so what works to take one person on a journey doesn't work for another. But I try personally to approach things collaboratively as I can and try to help people to understand what they might be gaining rather than what they might fear that they're losing. I think change management can be really, really difficult, usually because human beings fear what they don't know and they fear what they're going to lose or what they perceive they're going to lose, rather than focusing on the positive and what they stand to gain as a consequence of the change. There's a great book, actually. It's an oldie but a goodie, called Who Moved My Cheese?
Oh, yeah.
Which is just a great book. Yeah, you remember?
I do remember.
Just a great book about change management. So if anybody hasn't read it or like reread it, it's a goodie.
Yeah, it's a classic for sure. Okay, last question. Having hindsight is being the benefactor of hindsight is what you gain from years of experience. What advice might you give to your younger self about what's ahead of your career?
That is a goodie. Hindsight is often 20/20. What I continue to learn to this day, so this is not just advice for my young self, this is advice for myself right now today, is to never assume. Never assume. There's a saying, which I won't say on this podcast in the interest of keeping it clean, but assumption makes a out of you and me. And it's an ongoing lesson, I think, probably for lots of people, to assume that everybody has the same understanding you do, to assume a job has been done, to assume anything is probably to set yourself and others up to fail. So never assume is my advice to my young self.
Wonderful. And with that, we are going to wrap it. Liana, I want to thank you very much for your time, for your insight. I think this is going to be a great episode for our listeners. And with that, I'll say goodbye to the listeners. Thanks again for listening to the Revenue Lounge. We'll see you next time.